That was really good, what you did with the box, said Carlo. None of us can work it that fast, said Guldo. And we're good with sums. Or at least, said Guldo, we thought we were until we met you.
It was nothing, said Jean. I can be even faster. I meant to say...
He looked nervously at Father Chains before continuing.
I need optics, reading optics for things up close. I can't see right without them. I could work a box even faster if I had them, but I lost mine. One of the boys in Shades Hill...
You shall have new ones, said Chains, tomorrow or the next day. Don't wear them in public. It might contravene our air of poverty, but you can certainly wear them in here.
You couldn't even see straight, asked Locke, when you beat me. I could see a little bit, said Jean. It's all sort of blurry. That's why I was leaning back so far.
A mathematical terror, mused Father Chains, and a capable little brawler. What an interesting combination the benefactor has given the gentleman bastards in young Master Tannen. And he is a gentleman bastard, isn't he, Locke?
Yes, said Locke. I suppose he is.
4. The next night was clear and dry. All the moons were up, shining like sovereigns in the blackness with the stars for their court. Jean Tannen sat beneath one parapet wall on the temple roof, a book held out before him at arm's length. 2 oil lamps in glass boxes sat beside him, outlining him in warm yellow light.
"I don't mean to bother you," said Locke,
and Jean looked up, startled.
"Gods, you're quiet."
"Not all the time." Locke stepped to within a few feet of the larger boy.
"I can be very loud when I'm being stupid. Can I sit?"
Jean nodded, and Locke plopped down beside him. He folded his legs and wrapped his arm around his knees.
"I am sorry," said Locke. "I guess I really can be a shit sometimes." "I'm sorry, too. I didn't mean... when I hit you, it just... I'm not myself when I'm angry." "You did right. I didn't know about your mother and your father. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have presumed. I've had a long time to get used to it, you know."
The 2 boys said nothing for a few moments after that. Jean closed his book and stared up at the sky.
"You know, I might not even be one after all," Locke said. "A real orphan, I mean."
"How so?"
"Well, my mother's dead. I saw that. I know that. But my father, he went away when I was very little. I don't remember him. Never knew him."
"I'm sorry," said Jean.
"We're both sorry a lot, aren't we? I think he might have been a sailor or something. Maybe a mercenary, you know. Mother never wanted to talk about him. I don't know. I could be wrong."
"My father was a good man," said Jean. "He was... they both had a shop in North Corner. They shipped leathers and silks and some gems. All over the Iron Sea, some trips inland. I helped them. Not shipping, of course, but record-keeping, counting. And I took care of the cats. We had 9. Mama used to say... she used to say that I was her only child who didn't go about on all 4s.
He sniffled a bit and wiped his eyes.
"I seem to have used up all my tears," he said. "I don't know what to feel about all this any more. My parents taught me to be honest, that the laws and the gods abhor thieving. But now I find out thieving has its very own god, and I can either starve on the street or be comfortable here."
"It's not so bad," said Locke. "I've never done anything else, as long as I can remember. Thieving is an honest trade, when you look at it like we do. We can work really hard at it sometimes." Locke reached inside his tunic and brought out a soft cloth bag.
"Here,"
he said, handing it over to Jean.
What's this?"
"You said you needed optics." Locke smiled.
"There's a lens grinder over in the Videnza who's older than the gods. He doesn't watch his shop window like he ought to. I lifted some pears for you.
Jean shook the bag open and found himself looking down at 3 pairs of optics. There were 2 circular sets of lenses in gilt wire frames and a square set with silver rims.
I... thank you, Locke.
He held each pair up to his eyes and squinted through them in turn, frowning slightly.
I don't quite know. I'm not ungrateful, not at all, but none of these will work.
He pointed at his eyes and smiled sheepishly.
Lenses need to be made for the wearer's problem. There's some for people who can't see long ways, and I think that's what these pairs are for, but I'm what they call close blind, not far blind.
Oh, damn! Locke scratched the back of his neck and smiled sheepishly.
I don't wear them. I didn't know. I really am an idiot. Not at all. I can keep the rims and do something with them, maybe. Rims break. I can just set proper lenses in them. There'll be spares. Thank you again.
The boys sat in silence for a short while after that, but this time it was a companionable silence. Jean leaned back against the wall and closed his eyes. Locke stared up at the moons, straining to see the little blue and green specks Chains had once told him were the forests of the gods. Eventually, Jean cleared his throat.
So you're really good at stealing things?
I have to be good at something. It's not fighting, and it's not mathematics, I guess.
Father Chains told me about this thing you can do if you pray to the benefactor. He called it a death offering. Do you know about that?
Oh, said Locke. I know all about it. Truth of all 13 gods, cross my heart and pray to die.
I'd like to do that, for my mother and my father, but I've never stolen anything. Can you maybe help me?
Teach you how to steal, so you can do a proper offering?
Yes.
Jean sighed.
I guess if this is where the gods have put me, I should bend to local custom.
Can you teach me how to use a numbers box so I look less like a half-wit next time?
I think so, said Jean.
Then it's settled.
Locke jumped back up to his feet and spread his hands wide.
Tomorrow, Carlo and Galdo can plant their arses on the temple steps. You and I will go out and plunder.
That sounds dangerous, said Jean.
For anyone else, maybe. For gentlemen bastards, well, it's just what we do.
We?
We.
Chapter 6. Limitations. 1. The red hands led Locke up the long gangway to the floating grave just as the scarlet sun broke above the dark buildings of the Ashfall district. The whole wooden waste turned to blood in that light, and when Locke blinked to clear the brightness from his eyes, even the darkness flashed with red. Locke struggled to keep his head clear. The combination of nervous excitement and fatigue always made him feel as though he was sliding along an inch or two above the ground, his feet not quite reaching all the way down. There were sentries on the quay, sentries at the doors, sentries in the foyer, more than there had been before. They were all grim-faced and silent as the red hands led Locke deeper into the Kappa's floating fortress. The inner clockwork doors weren't locked. Kappa Barsavi stood in the middle of his great audience chamber, facing away from Locke, his head bowed and his hands behind his back. Curtains had been drawn away from the high glass windows on the eastern side of the galleon's hull. Red fingers of light fell on Barsavi, his sons, a large wooden cask, and a long object that lay covered on a portable wooden bier.
"Father," said Andres, "it's Lamora."
Kappa Barsavi grunted and turned. He stared at Locke for a few seconds, his eyes glassy and dead. He waved his left hand.
"Leave us," he said. "Leave us now."
Heads down, Andres and Pachero hurried out of the room, dragging the red hands with them. A moment later the hall echoed with the sound of the doors slamming shut and the clockwork locks tumbling into position.
"Your Honor," said Locke, "what's going on?" "The bastard killed her, Locke,"
He killed Nazca last night, left us the body just a few hours ago.
Locke stared at Barsavi, dumbfounded, aware that his mouth was hanging open.
But she was here, wasn't she?
She left.
Barsavi was clenching and unclenching his fists.
She snuck off, near as we can tell, or she was taken. Second or third hour of the morning. She was returned at 4:30 the fourth hour of the morning.
Returned? By whom?
Come, see.
Vincarlo Barsavi drew back the cloth that covered the bier, and there lay Nazca, her skin waxy, her eyes closed, her hair damp. Two livid purple bruises marred the otherwise smooth skin on the left side of her neck. Locke felt his eyes stinging, and he found himself biting down hard on the first knuckle of his right index finger.
"See what the bastard has done," Barsavi said softly. "She was the living memory of her mother, my only daughter. I would rather be dead than see this."
Tears began sliding down the old man's cheeks.
"She has been washed."
"Washed? What do you mean?"
"She was returned," said the copper. "In that."
He gestured to the cask, which stood upright a few feet to the side of the bier.
"In a barrel?"
"Look inside."
Locke slid the barrel's cover back and recoiled as the full stench of the barrel's contents wafted out at him. It was full of urine, horse urine, dark and cloudy. Locke whirled away from the cask and clapped both hands over his mouth, his stomach spasming.
"Not just killed," said Barsavi, "but drowned. Drowned in horse piss."
Locke growled, fighting tears.
"I can't believe this. I just can't believe it. This doesn't make any fucking sense."
He moved back beside the bier and took another look at Nazca's neck. The purple bruises were actually raised bumps. Straight red scratches were visible just in front of them. Locke stared at them, thinking back to the feel of talons in his own skin. The injury on his forearm still burned.
"Your Honor," he said slowly, "maybe she was returned in that thing, but I'm pretty sure she didn't drown in it."
"What can you possibly mean?"
"The marks on her neck, the little scratches beside them?"
Locke extemporized, keeping his voice level and his face neutral. "What would sound plausible?"
"I've, seen them before. Several years ago in Talisham, I saw a man murdered by a scorpion hawk. Have you ever heard of such a thing?"
"Yes," said the copper. "An unnatural hybrid, some sort of creature dreamed up by the sorcerers of Carthain. Is that the marks on her neck? Can you be sure?"
"She was stung by a scorpion hawk," Locke said. "The talon marks beside the wounds are clear. She would have been dead almost instantly."
"So he merely pickled her afterward,"
Barsavi whispered.
"To increase the insult, to cut me more cruelly."
"I'm sorry," said Locke. "I know it can't be much comfort."
"If you're right, it was a much quicker death."
Barsavi pulled the cloth back up over her head, running his fingers through her hair one last time before he covered her completely.
"If that is the only comfort I can pray that my little girl received, I will pray for it. That grey bastard will receive no such comfort when his time comes. I swear it."
"Why would he do this?"
Locke ran both of his hands through his hair, wide-eyed with agitation.
"It doesn't make any sense. Why her? Why now?"
"He can tell you himself," said Barsavi.
"What? I don't understand."
Kappa Barsavi reached into his vest and drew out a folded piece of parchment. He passed it over to Locke, who opened the fold and saw that a note was scribed there in a clean, even hand.
Barsavi. For the necessity of what was done, we apologize, though it was done to facilitate your understanding of our power, and therefore your cooperation. We earnestly desire a meeting with yourself, man to man, in all courtesy, to settle once and for all between us this matter of Camor. We shall be in attendance at the Echo Hole, at the 11th hour of the evening, on the Duke's Day 3 nights hence. We shall be alone and unarmed, though you for your part may bring as many counsellors as you wish, and you may arm them as you wish. Man to man we may discuss our situation, and with the kind favour of the gods, perhaps abjure the need for you to lose any more of your loyal subjects, or any more of your own flesh and blood.
I don't believe it, said Locke. Meet in good faith after this?
He cannot be Camori, said Barsavi. I have become Camori in my years here. I am more of this place than many who were born here, but this man...
Barsavi shook his head vigorously. He cannot understand what an infamy he has done to get my attention.
What an insult my sons and I must bear if I negotiate with him. He wastes his time with this letter, and look, the royal we. What an affectation!
Your Honor, what if he does understand what he's done?
The possibility is very remote, Locke.
The copper chuckled sadly,
or else he would not have done it.
Not if you presume that the meeting at the Echo Hole is an ambush, that he wants to get you off the floating grave and into a place where he has prepared some real harm for you.
Your prudence again, Barsavi smiled without humour. The thought has occurred to me, Locke, but if he wanted me dead, why not strike from surprise months ago before he started killing my garistas? No. I believe he genuinely thinks that if he frightens me enough, I will negotiate in good faith. I'm indeed going to the Echo Hole. We shall have our meeting, and for my counselors I will bring my sons, my Berangius sisters, and 100 of my best and my cruelest, and I will bring you and your friend Jean.
Locke's heart beat against the inside of his chest like a trapped bird. He wanted to scream.
Of course, he said. Of course. Jean and I will do anything you ask. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Good. Because the only negotiation we'll be doing is with bolt, blade, and fist. I've got a surprise for that grey piece of shit, if he thinks to dictate terms to me over the body of my only daughter.
Locke ground his teeth together. I know what can bring him out from that soggy fortress of his, the Grey King had said.
Kappa Barsavi, said Locke, have you considered, well, the things they say about the Grey King? He can kill men with a touch, he can walk through walls, he can't be harmed by blades or by arrows.
Stories told in wine. He does as I did when I first took this city. He hides himself well, and he chooses his targets wisely.
The copper sighed.
I admit that he is good at it, perhaps as good as I was, but he's not a ghost.
There is another possibility, said Locke, licking his lips. How much of what was said here might reach the Grey King's ears? He'd unraveled the secrets of the gentleman bastards thoroughly enough. To hell with him.
The possibility of a... bondsmage. Aiding the Grey King?
Yes.
He's been vexing my city for months, Locke. It might explain some things, yes, but the price? Even I could not pay a bondsmage for that length of time.
Scorpion hawks, said Locke, aren't just created by the bondsmagi. As far as I know, only bondsmagi themselves keep them. Could an ordinary falconer train a bird that could kill him with one accidental sting? Bullshit well, he thought. Bullshit very well. The Grey King wouldn't need to have kept one this whole time. What if the bondsmage is newly arrived?
What if the bondsmage has only been hired for the next few days, the critical point of whatever the Grey King's scheme is? The rumours about the Grey King's powers could have been spread to prepare for all of this.
Fantastical, said Barsavi, and yet it would explain much.
It would explain why the Grey King is willing to meet you alone and unarmed. With a bondsmage to shield him, he could appear both, yet be neither.
Then my response is unchanged.
Barsavi squeezed one fist inside the other.
If one bondsmage can best 100 knives, including you and I, my sons, my Brangia sisters, your friend Jean and his hatchets, then the Grey King has chosen his weapons better than I. But for my part, I do not imagine that he has.
You will keep the possibility in mind? Locke persisted.
Yes, I shall.
Barsavi placed a hand on Locke's shoulder.
You must forgive me, my boy, for what has happened.
There's nothing to forgive, Your Honor. When the Kappa changes the subject, thought Locke, the subject is finished. It wasn't your fault.
It is my war. It's me the Grey King truly wishes to cut.
You offered me a great deal, sir. Locke licked his lips, which had suddenly gone dry. I'd very much like to help you kill the bastard.
So we shall. At the 9th hour of the evening, on Duke's Day, we begin to gather. Andres will come to fetch you and Tannen at the last mistake.
What of the Sansas? They're good with knives.
And with cards, or so I hear. I like them well enough, Locke, but they're fiddlers, amusers. I'm taking serious folk for serious business.
As you say.
Now.
Barsavi took a silk handkerchief from his vest pocket and slowly mopped his brow and cheeks with it.
Leave me, please. Come back tomorrow night as a priest. I'll have all my other priests of the benefactor. We'll give her a proper ritual.
Despite himself, Locke was flattered. The Kappa had known that all of Father Chain's boys were initiates of the benefactor, and Locke a full priest, but he'd never before asked for Locke's blessing in any official sense. Of course, he said quietly. He withdrew then, leaving the Kappa standing in the bloody morning light, leaving him all alone at the heart of his fortress, for the second time, with nothing but a corpse for company. 2.
Gentlemen,
said Locke, huffing and puffing as he closed the door to the seventh-floor rooms behind him.
We have done our bit for appearances this week. Let's all work out of the temple until further notice.
Jean was sitting in a chair facing the door, hatchets resting on his thigh, with his battered old volume of the Corish romances in his hands. Bug was snoring on a sleeping pallet, sprawled in one of those utterly careless positions that give instant arthritis to all save the very young and foolish. The Sansas were sitting against the far wall, playing a desultory hand of cards. They looked up as Locke entered.
"We are released from one complication," said Locke, "and flung headlong into another. And this bitch has teeth."
"What news?" said Jean.
"The worst sort."
Locke dropped into a chair, threw back his head and closed his eyes.
"Nazca's dead."
"What?"
Carlo leapt to his feet. Galdo wasn't far behind.
"How did that happen?"
"The Grey King happened.
It must have been the other business he referred to when I was his guest. He sent the body back to her father in a vat of horse piss."
"Gods," said Jean. "I'm so sorry, Locke."
"And now," continued Locke, "you and I are expected to accompany the Kappa when he avenges her at the clandestine meeting 3 nights hence, which will be at the Echo Hole, by the way. And the Kappa's idea of clandestine is 100 knives charging in to cut the Grey King to bloody pieces."
"Cut you to bloody pieces, you mean?" said Galdo.
"I'm well aware of who's supposed to be strutting around wearing the Grey King's clothes, thanks very much.
I'm just debating whether or not I should hang an archery butt around my neck. Oh, and wondering if I can learn to split myself in two before Duke's day.
This entire situation is insane. Jean slammed his book shut in disgust.
It was insane before. Now it's become malicious.
Why would the Grey King kill Nazca?
To get the Kappa's attention.
Locke sighed. Either to frighten him, which it certainly hasn't accomplished, or to piss him off beyond all mortal measure, which it has.
There will never be peace now. The Kappa will kill the Grey King or get himself killed trying.
Carlo paced furiously.
Surely the Grey King must realize this. He hasn't facilitated negotiations. He's made them impossible. Forever.
The thought had crossed my mind, said Locke, that the Grey King may not be telling us everything concerning this scheme of his.
Out the Viscount's gate, then, said Galdo. We can spend the afternoon securing transportation and goods. We can pack up our fortune, vanish onto the road. Fuck, if we can't find somewhere to build another life with 40,000 crowns at our fingertips, we don't deserve to live. We could buy titles in Lashane, make Bug a count and set ourselves up as his household. Or make ourselves counts, said Carlo, and set Bug up as our household. Run him back and forth. It'd be good for his moral education.
We can't, said Locke. We have to presume the Grey King can follow us wherever we go, or perhaps more accurately, that his bondsmage can. So long as the Falconer serves him, we can't run, at least not as a first option.
What about as a second? Asked Jean.
If it comes to that, we might as well try. We can get things ready, and if we absolutely must run for the road, well, we'll put ourselves in harness and pull with the horses if we have to.
Which leaves only the conundrum, said Jean, of which commitment to slip you out of the night of this meeting at the Echo Hole.
No conundrum, said Locke. The Grey King has it over us. Barsavi, we know we can fool. So I'll play the Grey King and figure out some way to ease us out of our commitment to the Kappa without getting executed for it.
That would be a good trick, said Jean.
But what if it's not necessary? Carlo pointed at his brother. One of us can play the Grey King, and you and Jean can stand beside Barsavi as required.
Yes, said Galdo. An excellent idea.
No, said Locke. For one thing, I'm a better false facer than either of you, and you know it. You two are just slightly too conspicuous. It can't be risked. For another, while I'm playing the Grey King, you two will be forgotten by everyone. You'll be free to move around as you like. I'd rather have you waiting with transportation at one of our meeting spots in case things go sour and we do need to flee.
And what about Bug? Bug, said Bug, has been faking snoring for the past few minutes, and I know the Echo Hole. I used to hide there sometimes when I was with the Shades Hill gang. I'll be down there under the floor beside the waterfall, watching for trouble.
Bug, said Locke, you'll...
If you don't like it, you'll have to lock me in a box to stop me. You need a spotter, and the Grey King didn't say you couldn't have friends lurking. That's what I do. I lurk. None of you can do it like I can, because you're all bigger and slower and creakier and...
Gods, said Locke, my days as a garrista are numbered. Duke Bug is dictating the terms of his service. Very well, Your Grace. I'll give you a role that will keep you close at hand, but you lurk where I tell you to lurk, right?
Bloody right!
Then it's settled, said Locke. And if no one else has a pressing need for me to imitate the great and powerful, or a friend of mine they'd like to murder, I could use some sleep.
It's too goddamned bad about Nazca, said Galdo. The son of a bitch.
Yes, said Locke. In fact, I'm going to speak to him about it this very evening. Him or his pet sorcerer, whichever thinks to come.
The candle, said Jean.
Yeah. After you and I finish our business, and after false light, you can wait down in the last mistake. I'll sit up here, light it, and wait for them to show.
Locke grinned.
Let those fuckers enjoy the walk up our stairs.
3. The day turned out clear and pleasant, the evening as fresh as they ever came in Camor. Locke sat in the 7th-floor rooms with the windows open and the mesh screens down as the purple sky lit up with rising streamers of ghostly light. The falconer's candle smouldered on the table beside the remains of Locke's small dinner and a half-empty bottle of wine. The other half of that bottle was warming Locke's stomach as he sat, facing the door, massaging the fresh dressing Jean had insisted on wrapping his arm with before taking up his post in the last mistake.
"Crooked Warden," said Locke to thin air, "if I'm pissing you off for some reason, you don't need to go to such elaborate lengths to chastise me. And if I'm not pissing you off, well, I pray that you still find me amusing."
He flexed the fingers of his injured arm, wincing, then took up his wine glass and the bottle one more time.
"A glass poured to air for an absent friend," he said as he filled it with dark red wine, a Nakotsa Retsina that had actually come from Don Salvara's upriver vineyards, a gift to Lucas Fairwhite as he stepped off the Don's pleasure barge so many days earlier, or not so many days earlier. It felt like a lifetime. "We miss Nazca Barsavi already, and we wish her well. She was a fair garista, and she tried to help her peasant out of an untenable situation for them both. She deserved better. Piss on me all you like, but do what you can for her. I beg this as your servant."
"If you wish to measure a man's true penitence," said the falconer, "observe him when he believes himself to be dining alone."
The front door was just closing behind the bondsmage. Locke had not seen or heard it open. For that matter, it had been bolted. The falconer was without his bird, and dressed in the same wide-skirted grey coat with silver-buttoned scarlet cuffs Locke had seen the night before. A grey velvet cap was tilted back atop his head, adorned with a single feather under a silver pin, easily identified as having come from Vestris.
"I, for one, have never been a very penitent man," he continued, "nor have I ever been overly fond of stairs."
"My heart is overcome with sorrow for your hardship," said Locke. "Where's your hawk?"
"Circling."
Locke was suddenly acutely aware of the open windows, such a comfort just a moment earlier. The mesh wouldn't keep Vestris out if the hawk decided to be unruly.
"I'd hoped that your master might come along with you."
"My client," said the bondsmage, "is otherwise occupied. I speak for him, and I will bear your words to him, assuming you have any worth hearing."
"I always have words," said Locke. "Words like complete lunatic and fucking idiot. Did it ever occur to you or your client that the one certain way to ensure that a Camori would never negotiate with you with any good faith would be to kill someone of his blood?"
"Heavens," said the falconer, "this is ill news indeed. And here the Grey King was so certain Barsavi would interpret his daughter's murder as a friendly gesture."
The sorcerer's eyebrows rose.
"I say, did you want to tell him yourself, or shall I rush off right now with your revelation?"
"Very funny, you half-copper cocksucker. While I agreed under duress to prance around dressed as your master, you must admit that sending the copper's only daughter back to him in a vat of piss does complicate my fucking job."
"A pity," said the bondsmage. "But the task remains, as does the duress."
"Barsavi wants me by his side at this meeting, falconer. He made the request this morning. Maybe I might have slipped out of it before, but now? Nazca's murder has put me in a hell of a squeeze."
"You're the thorn of Camor. I would be personally very disappointed if you couldn't find a way past this difficulty. Barsavi's summons is a request. My client's is a requirement."
"Your client isn't telling me everything he should."
"You may safely presume that he knows his own business better than you do."
The falconer began to idly wind a slender thread back and forth between the fingers of his right hand. It had an odd silver sheen.
"Gods damn it!" Locke hissed. "Maybe I don't care what happens to the Kappa, but Nazca was my friend. Duress I can accept. Gleeful malice I cannot. You fuckers didn't need to do what you did to her."
The falconer splayed his fingers and the thread gleamed, woven into a sort of cat's cradle. He began to move his fingers slowly, tightening some threads and loosening others, as deftly as the Sansas moved coins across the backs of their hands.
"I cannot tell you," said the sorcerer, "what a weight it is upon my conscience to learn that we might lose your gracious acceptance."
Then the falconer hissed a word, a single syllable in a language Locke didn't understand. The very sound was harsh and unnerving. It echoed in the room as though heard from a distance. The wood shutters behind Locke slammed closed, and he jumped out of his chair. One by one, the other windows banged shut, and their little clasps clicked, moved by an unseen hand. The falconer shifted his fingers yet again. Light gleamed on the web within his hands, and Locke gasped. His knees suddenly ached as though they'd been kicked from the sides, sharply.
"This is the second time," said the bondsmage, "that you have been flippant with me. I fail to find it amusing. So I will reinforce my client's instructions, and I shall take my time doing so."
Locke gritted his teeth. Tears sprang unbidden to his eyes as the pain in his legs intensified, throbbed, spread. It now felt as though a cold flame were playing against his knee sockets from the inside. Unable to support his own weight, he tottered forward. One hand clutched helplessly at his legs, while the other tried to hold him up against the table. He glared at the bondsmage and tried to speak, but found that the muscles of his neck began spasming as he did.
"You are property, Lamora. You belong to the Grey King. He cares not that Nazca Barsavi was your friend. It was her ill fortune to be born to the father the gods gave her."
The spasming spread down Locke's spine, across his arms and down his legs, where it met the freezing, gnawing pain already at work there in a hideous fusion. He fell onto his back, gasping, his face a rictus mask, his hands curved in the air above his head like claws.
"You look like an insect thrown into a fire, and this is the merest exercise of my art. The things I could do to you if I were to stitch your true name into cloth or scribe it on parchment. Lamora is obviously not your given name. It's Thrown Therin for shadow. But your first name, now that would be just enough to master you if I wished to make use of it."
The falconer's fingers flew back and forth, blurring in Locke's vision, shifting and stretching those silver threads, and the tempo of Locke's torment rose in direct proportion to the motion of that gleaming design. His heels were slapping against the floor, his teeth were rattling in his jaw. It seemed to him that someone was trying to cut the bones out of his thighs with icicles. Again and again he tried to suck in enough air to scream, but his lungs would not move. His throat was packed with thorns, and the world was growing black and red at the edges. Release itself was a shock. He lay on the ground, bonelessly, still feeling the ghosts of pain throbbing across his body. Warm tears slid down his cheeks.
"You're not a particularly intelligent man, Lamora. An intelligent man would never deliberately waste my time. An intelligent man would grasp the nuances of the situation without the need for repetition."
Another motion of blurred silver in the corner of Locke's vision, and new pain erupted in his chest, like a blossom of fire surrounding his heart. He could feel it there, burning the very core of his being. It seemed to him that he could actually smell the crisping flesh within his lungs, and feel the air in his throat warming until it was as hot as that of a bread oven. Locke groaned, writhed, threw his head back, and finally screamed.
"I need you," said the falconer, "but I will have you meek and grateful for my forbearance. Your friends are another matter. Shall I do this to Bug while you watch? Shall I do it to the Sansas?"
"No, please, no,"
Locke cried out, curled in agony, his hands clutching at his left breast. He found himself tearing at his tunic like an animal mad with pain.
"Not them!"
"Why not? They are immaterial to my client. They are expendable."
The burning pain abated, once again shocking Locke with its absence. He huddled on his side, breathing raggedly, unable to believe that heat so fierce could vanish so swiftly.
"Yes. Yes," said Locke. "Perfectly. Yes. Please don't harm them. I'll do whatever I must."
"Of course you will. Now, I've brought the components of the costume you'll be wearing at the Echo Hole. You'll find them just outside your door. They're appropriately theatrical. I won't presume to tell you how to make ready with your mummery. Be in position across from the Echo Hole at 10:30 on the night of the meeting. I shall guide you from there and direct you in what to say."
"Barsavi," Locke coughed out. "Barsavi will mean to kill me."
"Do you doubt that I could continue punishing you here at my leisure until you were mad with pain?"
"No, no."
"Then do not doubt that I can protect you from whatever nonsense the Kappa might wish to employ."
How do you mean to direct me?"
"I do not need the air,"
came the voice of the bondsmage, echoing in Locke's head with shocking force,
"to carry forth my instructions. When you require prompting in your meeting with Barsavi, I shall supply it. When you must make a demand or accept a demand, I shall let you know how to proceed. Is this clear?"
"Yes, perfectly clear. Thank you."
"You should be grateful for what my client and I have done on your behalf. Many men wait years for a chance to ingratiate themselves with Kappa Barsavi. Your chance has been served forth to you like a fine meal. Are we not generous?"
"Yes, certainly."
"Just so. I suggest you now find some means to extricate yourself from the duty he asks of you. This will leave you free to concentrate on the duty we require. We wouldn't want your attention divided at a critical moment."
4. The last mistake was half empty, a phenomenon Locke had never before witnessed. Conversation was muted, eyes were cold and hard. Entire gangs were conspicuous by their absence. Men and women alike wore heavier clothing than the season required, more half-cloaks and coats and layered vests. It was easier to conceal weapons that way.
"So what the hell happened to you?"
Jean helped Locke sit down. He'd gotten them a small table in a side cranny of the tavern, with a clear view of the doors. Locke settled into his chair, a slight echo of the falconer's phantom pain still haunting his joints and his neck muscles. "The falconer," Locke said in a low voice, "had several opinions he wished to express, and apparently I'm not as charming as I think I am." He idly fingered his torn tunic and sighed. "Beer now, bitch later." Jean slid over a clay mug of warm Komori ale, and Locke drank half of it down in 2 gulps. "Well," he said after wiping his mouth, "I suppose it was worth it just to say what I said to him. I don't believe Bonds Major are used to being insulted."
"Did you accomplish anything?"
"No." Locke drank the remaining half of his ale and turned the mug upside down before setting it on the tabletop. "Not a god's damned thing. I did get the shit tortured out of myself, though, which was informational from a certain point of view."
"That fucker."
Jean's hands balled into fists.
I could do so much to him without killing him. I very much hope I get to try. Save it for the Grey King, muttered Locke. My thoughts are that if we survive what's coming on Duke's Day night, he won't be able to keep the Falconer on retainer forever. When the bondsmage leaves, we talk to the Grey King again, with knives. Too right. We follow him if we have to. We've been needing something to do with all of our money. Here's something. Whenever that bastard can't pay his mage any more, we'll show him just how much we like being knocked around like handballs. Even if we have to follow him down the Iron Sea and around the Cape of Nessek and all the way to Balinel on the Sea of Brass. Now there's a plan. And what are you going to do tonight? Tonight? Locke grunted. I'm going to take Carlo's advice. I'm going to stroll over to the Gilded Lilies and get my brains wrenched out. They can put them back in the morning when they're through with me. I understand there's an extra fee involved, but I'll pay it. I must be going mad, said Jean. It's been 4 years, and all this time you've been... I'm frustrated, and I need a break, and she's 1,000 miles away, and I guess I'm human after all, gods damn it. Don't wait up. I'll walk with you, said Jean. It's not wise to be out alone on a night like this. The city's in a mood, now that word of Nazca's got around. Not wise? Locke laughed. I'm the safest man in Camor, Jean. I know for a fact I'm the only one that absolutely nobody out there wants to kill yet. Not until they've finished pulling my strings. 5. This isn't working, he said, less than 2 hours later. I'm sorry, it's not your fault. The room was warm and dark and exceedingly pleasant, ventilated by the soft swish of a wooden fan flapping back and forth in a concealed shaft. Water wheels churned outside the ornate house of the Gilded Lilies at the northern tip of the snare, driving belts and chains to operate many mechanisms of comfort. Locke lay on a wide bed with soft feather mattresses covered in silk sheets and overhung with a silk canopy. He sprawled naked in the soft red light of a misted alchemical globe, little stronger than scarlet moonlight, and admired the soft curves of the woman who was running her hands along the insides of his thighs. She smelled like mulled apple wine and cinnamon musk, and her curves were indeed admirable, yet he was nothing resembling aroused. "Felice, please," he said. "This was a bad idea."
"Your tents," whispered Felice. "You've obviously got something on your mind, and that cut on your arm, it can't be helping at all. Let me try a few things more. I'm always up for a professional challenge."
"I can't imagine anything would help." Locke could hear the pout in her voice, though her face was little more than soft slashes of shadow in the red half-light.
"There's wines, you know, alchemical ones from Talvarar, aphrodisiacs. Not cheap, but they do work."
She rubbed his stomach, toying with the slender line of hair that ran down its center.
"They can work miracles."
"I don't need wine," he said distantly, grabbing her hand and moving it away from his chin. "Gods, I don't know what I need."
"Allow me to make a suggestion, then."
She moved herself up on the bed until she was crouched beside his chest, on her knees. With one confident motion, for there was real muscle under those curves, she flipped him over onto his stomach and began kneading the muscles of his neck and back, alternating gentle caresses and firm pressure.
"Suggestion, ow, accepted."
"Locke,"
Felice said, losing the breathy, anything-to-please-you bedroom voice that was one of the cherished illusions of her trade.
"You do know that the attendants in the waiting chambers tell us exactly what each client requests when they give us assignments?"
"So I've heard."
"Well, I know you specifically asked for a redhead."
"Which..." "Ow! Lower, please."
"Which means?" "There's only two of us in the Lilies," she said. "And we get that request every now and again.
But the thing is, some men want any redhead in general, and some men want one redhead in particular.
Oh.
Those that want a redhead in general have their fun and go their way, but you, you want one redhead in particular, and I'm not her.
I'm sorry, I said it's not your fault.
I know, that's ever so gracious of you.
And I'm happy paying anyways.
And that's also sweet, she chuckled. But you'd be taking it up with the room full of armed men if you didn't, not just worrying about hurting my poor feelings.
You know, Locke said, I think I prefer you like this to all that, how may I please you, master, bullshit earlier.
Well, some men like a straightforward whore. Some don't want to hear anything but how wonderful they are.
She worked at his neck muscles with the bases of her palms.
It's all business. But like I said, you seem to be pining for someone. And now that you've remembered yourself, I won't do.
Sorry.
No need to keep apologizing to me. You're the one whose lady love ran halfway across the continent.
Gods! Locke groaned. Find me a single person in Camor who doesn't know, and I'll give you 100 crowns, I swear.
It's just something I heard from one of the Sansas.
One of the Sansas? Which one?
Couldn't say. They're so hard to tell apart in the dark.
I'm going to cut their god's damned tongues out.
Oh, she ruffled his hair. Please don't. Us girls have a use for those, at least. You poor sweet idiot. You do have it bad for her. Well, what can I say, Locke? You're fucked.
Felice laughed softly.
Just not by me.
Interlude. Brat Masterpieces. 1. The summer after Jean came to the Gentleman Bastards, Father Chains took him and Locke up to the temple roof one night after dinner. Chains smoked a paper-wrapped sheaf of Jeremite tobacco, while the sunlight sank beneath the horizon, and the court fire of the city's elderglass rose glimmering in its place. That night he wanted to talk about the eventual necessity of cutting throats.
"I had this talk with Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha last year," he began. "You boys are investments, in time and treasure both."
He exhaled ragged crescents of pale smoke, failing as usual to conjure full rings.
"Big investments, my life's work, maybe. A pair of brat masterpieces. So I want you to remember that you can't always smile your way around a fight. If someone pulls steel on you, I expect you to survive. Sometimes that means giving back in kind. Sometimes it means running like your ass is on fire. Always it means knowing which is the right choice. And that's why we've got to talk about your inclinations."
Chains fixed Locke with a stare while he took a long, deliberate drag on his sheaf, the final breath of a man treading in unpleasant water, preparing to go under the surface.
"You and I both know that you have multiple talents, Locke, genuine gifts for a great many things. So I have to give this to you straight. If it comes down to hard talk with a real foe, you're nothing but a pair of pissed breeches and a bloodstain. You can kill, all right, that's the God's own truth, but you're just not made for stand-up, face-to-face bruising, and you know it, right?"
Locke's red-cheeked silence was an answer in itself. Suddenly unable to look Father Chains in the eyes, he tried to pretend that his feet were fascinating objects that he'd never seen before.
"Locke, Locke, we can't all be mad dogs with a blade in our hands, and it's nothing to sob about, so let's not see that lip of yours quivering like an old whore's tits, right? You will learn steel, and you'll learn rope, and you'll learn the alley piece, but you'll learn them sneak style. In the back, from the side, from above, in the dark."
Chains grabbed an imaginary opponent from behind, left hand round the throat,
right hand thrusting at kidney level with his half-smoked sheaf for a dagger. All the twists, because fighting wisely will keep you from getting cut to mince. Chains pretended to wipe the blood from his ember-tipped blade, then took another drag. That's that. Put it in your hat and wear it to town, Locke. We need to face our shortcomings head on. The old saying for a gang is, lies go out, but the truth stays home. He forced twin streams of smoke from his nostrils and cheered up visibly as the tails of grey vapour swirled around his head. Now quit acting like there's a fucking naked woman on your shoes, will you? Locke did grin at that, weakly, but he also looked up and nodded. Now you, Chains said, turning to regard Jean. We all know you've got the sort of temper that cracks skulls when it's off the leash. We've got a properly evil brain in Locke here, a fantastic liar. Carlo and Galdo are silver at all trades and gold at none. Sabatha's the born queen of all the charmers that ever lived. But what we don't have yet is a plain old bruiser. I think it could be you, a stand-up brawler to keep your friends out of trouble. A real rabid dog bastard with steel in your hand. Care to give it a go? Jean's eyes were immediately drawn down to the fascinating spectacle of his own feet.
Well, if you think that would be good, I can try.
Jean, I've seen you angry.
I've felt you angry, said Locke, grinning.
And give me some credit for being 5 times your fucking age, Jean. You don't smoulder and you don't make threats, you just go cold, and then you make things happen. Some folks are made for hard situations.
He drew smoke from his sheaf once again and flicked white ashes to the stones beneath his feet.
I think you have the knack for smacking brains out of heads. That's neither good nor bad in itself, but it's something we can use.
Jean seemed to think this over for a few moments, but Locke and Chains could both see the decision already made in his eyes. They had gone hard and hungry under his black tangle of hair, and his nod was just a formality.
Good, good. Thought you'd like the idea, so I took the liberty of making arrangements.
He produced a black leather wallet from one of the pockets of his coat and handed it over to Jean.
12:30 tomorrow. You're expected at the House of Glass Roses.
Locke and Jean both widened their eyes at the mention of Camor's best-known and most exclusive school of arms. Jean flipped the sigil wallet open. Inside was a flat token, a stylized rose in frosted glass fused directly onto the inner surface of the leather. With this, Jean could pass north over the Angevine and past the guard posts to the Alchigrante Islands. It placed him under the direct protection of Don Tomsa Maranzala, master of the House of Glass Roses.
That rose will get you over the river and up among the swells, but don't fuck around once you're up there. Do what you're told. Go straight there and come straight back. You go 4 times a week from now on. And for all our sakes, tame that mess on top of your head. Use fire and a poleaxe if you have to.
Chains took a final drag of evergreen-scented smoke from his rapidly disappearing sheaf, then flicked the butt up and over the roof wall. His last exhalation of the night sailed over the heads of the two boys, a wobbly but otherwise fully formed ring.
Fuck me, an omen.
Chains reached after the drifting ring as though he could pluck it back for examination.
Either this scheme is fated to work out, or the gods are pleased with me for engineering your demise, Jean Tannen. I love a win-win proposition. Now don't you two have work to do?
2.
In the House of Glass Roses, there was a hungry garden. The place was Camor in microcosm, a thing of the Eldrin left behind for men to puzzle over,
a dangerous treasure discarded like a toy. The elder glass that mortared its stones rendered it proof against all human arts, much like the five towers and a dozen other structures scattered over the islands of the city. The men and women who lived in these places were squatters in